The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, a very good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine on this Friday. It's the 3rd of March, 2023. I hope you are well. And hopefully you'll stick with us now for the next 3 hours in this program and throughout the day, of course, on your number one local radio station. Later on, we have Michael in studio for That's Entertainment, and there's plenty to keep you here between 10 and 11 as well. But for the next hour, it is our Friday panel, and we want you involved in that conversation. 086 60 25000. WhatsApps and texts to have your views as we go along, or give us a call on 074 91 25000. Emails come into us, comments at highlandradio.com. Or you can watch the show on your Fire Stick, your smart TV, your tablet, your mobile device via Facebook or YouTube. Just search Highland Radio Ireland and give the page a like and a subscribe. Okay, let's say good morning to our panel, and we'll say good morning first to Barbara Ní Cathal, Irish Language Planning Coordinator for Letterkenny. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Greg. Good to be here.
It's great to have you on the programme. Deputy Thomas Pringle's with us as well. Good morning to you, Thomas. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm okay. Barely recognisable, I must say. I know it's quite predictable.
Who you are?
I know it's quite a predictable thing to say, but it's quite a beard. So that's all I will say. Well worth logging on just to see it. Very luxurious. And last but not least, the clean shave, and Damien Dowds, editor of the Inishowen Independent newspaper. Good morning to you, Damien.
Good morning, Greg.
Thank
clean
you.
Shaving on the top and on the bottom here, Greg.
Well, I'm compensating. I just want something to groom, and I have nothing to groom for 25 years. So. Anyway, it's all good. It's all good. Okay, let's kick off with some conversations here. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar said he expects an inquiry into the COVID-19 pandemic will begin this year. Micheál Martin kind of referred to it, I think, as a look back, but Varadkar talking about an inquiry. During the acute phase of the pandemic, thousands of people died from coronavirus, died with it. I'll correct if you don't mind. And the state brought in an unprecedented number of restrictions on individual liberty to stop the spread of the virus. Last year, then Taoiseach Micheál Martin promised a comprehensive evaluation that could inform how officials deal with future pandemic, and his successor agrees it would be a good idea. So there are a cohort of people out there, I think, that thinks it's valuable for us to learn any lessons that we need to learn. There are others out there who feel vindicated and want heads on a stick. What do you think we should get? What do you want looked at Sorry, I'll start with you, Thomas Pringle.
I think it is important that such a big event in the nation's history and the world's history, I suppose, but it's important that we look at it and look at the responses and see what worked and what didn't work. I mean, I think there is some things that would have been in the initial stages deemed to be necessary, but as time passed, it was shown that they weren't necessary. I don't know how you would actually, it was so new and so novel, and that everybody had to learn from day one, and maybe they could have reacted a bit quicker or something like that there. They could have saved more lives and stuff like that there. You know, and there was stuff like the hand washing and everything that there was deemed necessary, and then it wasn't, as time went on, it was discovered that it wasn't as significant as obviously breathing and controlling how people's interaction with each other and stuff like that there, you know. So those things have to be learned, because of the future. I think that probably in the current climate that there will be future pandemics as well, you know, and so that those lessons have to be learned for going into the future. So I think it is important that we look back and see what worked and what didn't work.
Through much of the pandemic, I got the impression from your statements and comments that you didn't actually think the government was going far enough. You were often calling for a zero COVID strategy. We did see that employed in China with disastrous results. Like, when you're calling for something like that, where are you getting your information from? Like, are you mustering that yourself, or do you have people that you speak to that you trust their medical opinion on? Because, of course, as I say, you know, you were a bit of an outlier with a few others in calling for even stronger measures, some could argue, than the government was actually putting in place.
Yeah, some of them, some of them. That's true. Like, and so I would have thought that at the time that we could have actually prevented a lot of the deaths that happened, and that thereby having a stronger measures at the time, you know, and that's something that needs to be looked at too. And maybe there could have been a lot stronger measures done that could have prevented a lot more deaths. That we just don't know. And like, nobody, I don't think anybody has had the divine knowledge of what is actually was going to work and what wasn't going to work. Like, and there was actually, it worked out that, you know, that hand washing wasn't as necessary as at first thought when the COVID hit and that there too. You know, so there, I think there's lessons for everybody to learn. Mm. I think we have to be big enough to be able to review what happened and see where the learnings are, what could have been done better and what could have been...
And before I bring the others in, you know, there were some things that were... are still debated today. There are still some that will debate whether or not schools sort of opened or closed. And I mean those in medical professionalism. There's not in the medical profession, there is not an agreement there as such. But one thing that we were talking about on this programme at the time, right at the very beginning, when, you know, there wasn't PPE or proper supports in nursing homes, for example, and sick people were being taken from hospitals, and we'd seen what was happening in Italy, and being discharged into nursing homes. And now we've learned that there was a horrendous loss of life in our nursing homes. That was wrong at the time, and we knew it was wrong at the time. It was being called out as such at the time. But I just wondered, was the opposition, and I mean, it's a broad term, through much of what we were going through, the opposition told a line, I think. Do you think the opposition did enough to call out the government when it was quite clear certain decisions were wrong?
Possibly, you know, and that's something we would probably need to learn on it as well in relation to it. But you know, I think everybody should be open to seeing what's happening, and it's not about people heads rolling now and then you got there. It's about learning so that we know for the future that maybe things can be done different, and that maybe a different tack could be taken that would actually get us through to the same outcome, but maybe not have it as hard on people during the process and that as well. And it's a very difficult thing. Like, you know, when you're looking at a completely new virus and people are dying and you don't know, they're not sure what works and what doesn't work, I suppose it's hard to make a judgment call. And, you know, and if you make the wrong call, more people will die. And that was the situation. Maybe the opposition could have taken a more confrontational view and opposed what the government was doing. But then we didn't have any divine knowledge either as what was right or what was wrong either. And we could only go by what... our view was and what we felt in relation to it. But now is the time, I think, that we look back and see what did work and what didn't work and see how we can change that in the future as well.
Barbara, I suppose there's two things going on here. There's what we knew then or what might have happened then and hindsight. Like, I was speaking to a lady yesterday who works with older people and is an older person herself. And she said what happened to older people during the pandemic was a disgrace, right? But I asked her yesterday, did you think it was a disgrace at the time? And she says no, but on reflection it was. Do you know what I mean? So in other words, it's learned information. So I suppose that there's a difference between sort of what we knew were bad decisions at the time and what sort of we've learned from now, because I think they're kind of two different things.
I think that's true, but I think we need to look at, like, for example, the way fear was used. And we were all terrified into submission. And I think that was absolutely wrong. There's a difference between providing information and actually using fear to enforce regulations and restrictions that didn't necessarily make any sense. And I think there was scientific data already coming through and available from where the virus had developed earlier than it developed in Ireland that would have indicated that maybe some of what we were being asked to do didn't make sense. And I think at the time, you know, the use of that, the use of fear as an element of control was very questionable right from the beginning. So I think we do need to ask questions about that. Professor Martin Cormacan, who is, he was a member of NPHET, and he is a professor in Galway University, and he gave an address there recently to the Irish Society of Clinical Microbiologists, and he is fairly scathing about some of the restrictions that were imposed, about the way that fear was used, and about this mantra of follow the science. That those who were speaking on a daily basis to us and were telling us to follow the science gave an impression that they did have the divine insight, that they did know. And in reality, in many ways, you know, science is about inquiry. It's about continual curiosity. It's not about, yeah, we've arrived at the final answer, but we were given the impression that those in a position of influence had the answers and that we needed to pay attention. And I think in terms of what happened to elderly people, I mean, there was an elderly aunt of mine who, in a nursing home, not in Donegal, who got COVID. And we were very aware from the beginning that if she didn't pull through this on her own, there was no way she was being sent to hospital. And at the time, we knew that was wrong. You know, elderly relatives who were left without people visiting them, you know, seeing somebody through a window.
But again, at that time, you know, and people can might say, oh, well, the media this, the media that and the other. Like, we tried to limit the fear on this program, and all the tapes are there. You know, all the shows are on Facebook.
There's I'm not being defensive,
but it was the fear thing. It was scaring people, right? But at that time, okay, at that time, you're being told that if one case gets into a nursing home, it's a wipeout. You know, so who is going to say, sling those doors of the nursing homes open?
No, and it wasn't that. But on the one hand, they were saying, you know, you can't have any visiting, but we'll move people out of hospitals into the nursing homes who've got COVID. So there was a complete imbalance.
Yeah, that
on
was
the
wrong
one
at
hand,
the time. That was,
you know,
horrific.
And that's what doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And I think, you know, we do need to have an inquiry, because we need to look at, if this was to happen again, and in all likelihood it will, how would we do things differently? And I think there are a lot of questions to be asked about the collateral damage that was done to people's physical health, to mental health, to people who were already vulnerable, who were deprived of services. I mean, if you look at children who maybe were already struggling at school or had additional needs, children maybe with less capacity for support at home, those kids were effectively abandoned for months and months, because the schools could do so much, but the schools weren't at home with them. The services, the early intervention, all of that was just missing. And there's a huge catch-up game happening at the moment with those services, with people going for diagnostic tests for things like cancer that were missed at the time. So we need to be able, if this and when this happens in the future, to be able to look much more realistically at what the threat is and what the collateral damage coming from very draconian measures is, and trying to get a much better balance on that. And that's something where I think we failed quite spectacularly.
Damien, it is, it's a difficult one, of course, but I think a lot of people realise that where was the sense in stopping pretty much all of healthcare other than dealing with COVID? Closing schools, do you know what I mean? Rather than maybe isolating those that were most vulnerable. Those are the types of conversations that we were having on programmes like this at that time. But they were being shut down, saying that, oh, if you do this, then that would happen and this would happen. But firstly, your view overall, but also I think serious questions and explanations as to why all elements of pretty much, it seemed, all elements of other healthcare and education, it was okay for that to be shut down. Like, who was being protected in that? Because at the same time, shops were open, supermarkets were open, B&Q was open, the coffee, you know what I mean? But you couldn't go in and get a scan, or you couldn't go in with your partner for a 20-week scan in a pregnancy, or, you know, the examples and scenarios are endless.
I suppose, like, there's, you know, while the pandemic, we kind of look it back now as just as a single thing out of a face, like there's different phases in it. And I suppose you'd have to consider how the state performed in all those phases, like, you know, and they differed from the start in the panic, whereas Thomas was saying about, you know, the hand washing, and people were washing their groceries and they brought them home because they thought the virus would live on surfaces, which, you know, quickly, well, not quickly, but within a few months was known not to be true. But that advice kept coming along, and we didn't probably appreciate at the start about kind of, you know, the aerosol transmission of it. Like, so it was coming in the air, and that was where maybe the focus should have been. And there were measures that were taken, you know, the closure of schools when we know, and it was known fairly quick, I think, that it wasn't really affecting children. And the measures that were put in place to just curtail education, to curtail grassroots sport. I remember at one stage, like, we were not allowed to go playing outside for months on end. Like, you know, when by that stage you knew that the virus wasn't going to be traveling through there on a windy day in Donegal, and that you couldn't go and meet and play a match or something. Like, you know, so there was a lot of things that were quite odd at the time. But I suppose, you know, you'd have to probably set it within the context. And, you know, the context that we looked at in a wider European global context, from what I can understand from it, while there was a large number of deaths, 6,000-7,000 deaths in the Republic and several thousand more in the North, like, the Republic seems to have done fairly well in terms of minimizing the number of deaths that came, which isn't to say that they were able to eradicate them and keep them out entirely.
But we're not really, we can't really clearly attribute those deaths actually to COVID as such, because, and as I say, the information was broadcast regularly on this show and posted on my Facebook page. The overwhelming majority of deaths right from the get-go were in people that had, you know, multiple other conditions, heart disease, absolutely cancer, don't. And so on and so forth. Like, right. So
famously, the people that had underlying health conditions were particularly vulnerable to complications arising from contracting COVID. That's, you know, that was my understanding of the thing. So those people became particularly vulnerable. And when they, or if they contracted COVID, the medical challenges they faced were more so than the medical challenges that someone faced that didn't have an underlying health condition. So, I mean, so a lot of work was probably done to try and protect those people. And look, it's this question, of course, Greg, is whether they died with COVID or from COVID. But, you know, if someone has, you know, an underlying condition, someone has diabetes or whatever, and they're in their 80s, and they don't contract COVID, they can live a number of healthy years after that. They contract COVID, they're in a lot of trouble with it because they have an underlying condition. Like, I suppose, then post-vaccination, and, you know, the pandemic probably changed then and how it was being dealt with. Like, so you'd have to look at the pandemic in a number of phases. Like, how did we, you know, after a wave of vaccinations that took place in and around what was it, late 2020 into early 2021, when the first vaccinations started coming out, I mean, we still had, you know, some curtailments in place all through that year and into early 2022. Even there were some after a big wave, I think it was the Omicron wave, as it came in around Christmas 2021. You know, there was curtailment that came in after that as well. And you'd have to wonder whether those were as necessary as maybe the ones were in the first phase. That March to June of 2020, you know, everyone was scrambling around all around the world. We didn't know what was happening. We've seen the pictures coming out of Italy, pictures coming out of elsewhere. So we didn't know what was happening at that day. You have to look at it in phases, I think. And it should absolutely be done, because there will be lessons. And, you know, the comments from Professor Carmichael, like, you know, he was one voice within the NPHET. His comments are very interesting. And, you know, it would be interesting to see the people that were on the NPHET. It was a wide organization, and there was there was views within it that were probably being expressed that we weren't hearing when we were seeing the nightly briefing. You know, because as he said, there was kind of dominant figures in it that were able to kind of direct the thing. But that's how a group of 40 works. And as far as I can gather, both the government, and the opposition, they largely took NPHET at its word.
Well, I think they did completely, and that's what's going to be my next question. I mean, the politicians are there. And as I say, this is not a brand new conversation, because it's all very, very clear in my head. Who was challenging NPHET, though? Who was going back to NPHET and saying, you know, I mean, it is not the government's job to solely implement what NPHET says. They're elected as well, presumably, to challenge it or to seek alternative information or to go through it. But it was NPHET said this on a Thursday, it's in on Friday.
I will suppose that the thing with NPHET as well is that on the one occasion, I'm trying to remember it now, there's so many of them, like, but on one occasion...
Leo Varadkar.
Leo Varadkar, didn't do what happened, and then there was a massive spike in cases. So NPHET's kind of you know, Neffet's advice then after that became even more solid. Yeah. Look, they, in fairness to Neffet as well, like there's 40 in the main thing and there's 120 in the wider group and so on. I mean, those are the medical and scientific experts that the state had available to it. It was going to be very hard for Thomas or for any politician to be able to challenge that. And that
well, Thomas was, Thomas was challenging them at the same time, probably on the wrong side of history, but he was challenging them nonetheless. Barbara, I just want to... You know, like even now at the moment, like in the last Donegal game, there was a vaccine tent popped up. It's only in the last couple of weeks that they've rolled out the vaccine to children, babies, effectively. So we're not living in, you know, post COVID. We're in it in the now, right? And now people are listening to this and going, oh, okay, well, we're having a conversation like nothing happened here, and they're still offering vaccines. What do I do? Like we're in it now. It's live at the moment, Barbara. Like, I think the government or whomever needs to come out, right, go on the Late Late Show or whatever they normally do and start having a conversation about, well, what is the current risk now? Because there are probably people going for vaccines and getting their children vaccinated. Do they need to be doing that now? I mean, should we not be having that conversation too, seeing as we're having, you know, not a historic one? Let's talk about the present at the moment as well.
I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, I think... Yes, we are now in a phase of living with COVID, just as we live with the reality of flu and we live with the reality of other respiratory conditions. And those respiratory conditions and flu and things like that are the main cause of death in that very elderly population on an ongoing basis. That is the reality. I'm not a scientist, so I wouldn't be advising anybody one way or the other about vaccinations. But certainly it seems that for children with underlying vulnerabilities, it is a good idea to be vaccinated against the likes of COVID, just the way you would vaccinate them against anything else. But I think we do have to start moving into that phase where we're saying, no, this is just the reality. It is there and it's going to be there. It is now not a pandemic, it's an endemic. It is simply there. But it worries me when I go into institutions, into organizations, and I'm still seeing the stickers about stay 2 meters apart from each other and, you know, walk on the left and do this and do that, because I think there's that residual fear element. And I don't think people need that. I don't think we should have that in any schools. I don't think we should have that in public buildings. I think we need to move beyond that. We need to get rid of that. Now, if people want to wear a mask, go into mass or go on, you know, on the bus, entirely up to them, that's grand. But I think we need to get rid of those outward signs of, you know, that recall the pandemic. I do think we need to do that. And the other thing we need to do is to look at how COVID is still being used in some ways as an excuse within maybe some, you know, health providers and things like that. If you go into a GP surgery and you see a sign up saying, because of COVID, appointment times are limited to 10 minutes. And you think, well, what was the science behind that one? Mm. It's, you know, we're not going to get COVID until after the 10 minutes.
That's the serious stuff. And then there's simple stuff like why can't
appointments in the day?
Yeah, for sure.
And I think COVID has been used as an excuse.
For sure. And of course, lots of things have changed. Why can't an older person pay cash in a bus or cash at a turnstile at a GEA game?
Exactly.
Finally, before we move on, Deputy Pringle, I mean, obviously, you know, everyone weaponized everything now and you can't have a conversation with that. But people are going to say, oh, well, Ivor Cummins was right, Dolores Cahill was right, and this person was right. But look at people rewrite history as well. A lot of these conversations were happening on programs like this and elsewhere. Some people were right about some things. Some people were anti everything. So anything that wasn't perfect, they're going to be right on. You know, what we really need is actually just a look back. If people in certain areas were proven right, all well and good. But I'll tell you, no one was fully right because no one got it right across the world. So you can look at Sweden or you could look at here, there and everywhere. And, you know, and as well as that, too, for those who thought, oh, well, this was part of a big agenda and all this, you know, pre-Ukraine, Russia were caught up in this. China were only until last month were caught up on this. So fair play to anyone that could pull the wool over the West, China, Russia, North Korea's eyes. You know, the world was caught up in this. Everyone was. And I don't think there was any one organisation or group capable of pulling the strings across that group of individuals and countries.
No, I don't think so. Like, I mean, and you know, everybody, some people did things right, some people did things wrong. The same people did things right and wrong as well, and that's what needs to be learned. And I think what needs to be learned as well, we saw that actually the health services can work, and we saw that things can happen, and that homelessness can be sorted out during the COVID pandemic and stuff like that there. And that's all been very quickly forgotten as well by the political system and everybody else too. You know, so we saw that things can be done differently, and I think that's what we need to learn from, and we need to see. Like, and for example, like in the schools, I can't remember the name of the air filtration system that was supposedly rolled out in schools. Where's that gone now?
Where's that money gone?
Yeah, and that filtration system will be there for the next pandemic. We'll be able to help in that if there is one. But you know, it's gone now, and no mention of it at all anywhere. And you know, so those are the things we have to learn, and we have to learn, and we have to. Unfortunately, I think there probably will be another pandemic will come up at some stage in the next 4 or 5 years, I think. You know, so we can't be at the start of the next one wringing our hands saying, oh, what do we do? What do we do? We should have learning from the last one that we can actually help with dealing with the next one as well. And I think that's, there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's actually sensible thing to do, and you know, and not everybody has everything right at all the time, but we have to learn as much as we can from what happened.
Damien, finally on this, do you think the scope of this needs to be extended maybe into this year, where we have, it seems, we haven't the official statistics, but strong indicators of a large peak in excess deaths, just to see in the broader whole of COVID context, if it's connected, what we might need to learn from that. I mean, I think that would be, if you're gonna be looking at this, I would like to see it extended into what seemingly is a recent spike in excess deaths.
Yeah, I would imagine that would be right, because while, you know, for many of us, you know, we're looking back on COVID, as Barbara was saying there, you know, COVID remains with us, and you know, there's the virus is still circulating. It's less damaging now because so many of us have gained immunity, primarily through vaccination, some through infection as well, naturally. But it's definitely something that should be looked at, because we do know the delay on some of medical treatments, which, you know, as I recall, they were saying that doctors and dentists couldn't really be working in close proximity to people because they would be inhaling their carbon dioxide, what they were emitting from themselves, and maybe catching the virus from the air droplets that were moving through. So, you know, there was a lot of medicine that was put off at a time, and some of that may, of course, be catching up now. And that was something that was fairly well warned about at the time. But when you had the clear and present danger of COVID and the damage it could do, particularly to the elderly and particularly the people with underlying conditions, like, you know, it was, the people were caught, like the health authorities were caught between a rock and a hard place. And as Thomas said as well, actually, it's one of the things probably that, you know, probably won't come within the scope of this review, but the way in which the civil service, the public service, and stepped up and moved at pace, which isn't common for the public service, was tremendous. In fairness, you know, to them, like, you know, they really put their shoulders to the wheel for that period of time. They did a lot of things. There's a lot of different things done in health. There's a lot of different things done in social welfare, and they were done quick, and that pace has gone back now to the normal. I'm sure we'll have it. You know, next month, next week, or next year, like, you know, and that it's a pity that spirit that, you know, people put to it at that stage, and that all of society, including the public service, the civil servants, the health, everybody really went above and beyond and showed what could be done. And, you know, if there's a way of finding out how that was managed and how that could be replicated again, that might be quite good, leaving aside all the health sides of it as well.
Okay. Okay, it was interesting to hear comments from Rishi Sunak yesterday, or the day before, maybe it was yesterday, in trying to sell the Windsor framework. He was talking about how Northern Ireland's in this an amazing position whereby it has, you know, it's got the UK market, and then it's got access to this amazing, you know, European market, and it's on the pig's back. And I think it's been widely pointed out that really that kind of sounds like Britain before Brexit. And that's his argument for the Windsor framework to be accepted. The DUP are kind of out on their own on this one, I think. I'll start with you, Deputy Pringle, in that everyone else seems to think this is the breakthrough that was required. They're still holding fire. And in fact, different views within that party, senior people within it seem to have different views. Do you think eventually, though, once the dust settles, that they'll just say, right, we got enough and we can go back into government? Or will playing second fiddle to Sinn Féin be too much for them to swallow?
Well, that'll be interesting to see whether they can come to terms with that or not. But I think you probably will see, and unfortunately, I think it's probably going to take till after the local elections in the north that Sinn Féin or the DUP will probably then say that they can live with it or something like that there, if they're interested in going back into an assembly in terms of...
But they're not till next year, are they? So you're saying that the 20...
No, the local elections are May this year, I think.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, so, sorry, I'm confused. Yes, go ahead. You're right, of course.
That's like very, very quickly in the north, you come into election periods and stuff like that there, and that holds everything up. So I would imagine that it probably will be then before the actual DUP will say that they can accept it. And, I don't think there's anything much different in this proposals than what has been there before, but it's about the DUP finding a way to say that they actually had an impact and made things different. And I think it's about the Conservatives satisfying their own backbenchers and their own party policy in Westminster rather than doing anything in particularly in relation to the North and that too. You know, so I think it's going to take a bit of time, but I think probably we should hopefully see the resolution of it then.
Yeah, I mean, I think the DUP probably have secured the best of both worlds for the people and businesses of Northern Ireland. Enough of a win there for them to go into government. Or again, as I say, maybe it might be too bitter a pill. Sorry, do you want to come back, Thomas?
Yeah, well, I think they largely had the, I don't know if the DUP has secured the best for both worlds. I think that largely they had the best of both worlds.
But it can be framed with that in terms of the freedom of movement left and right or east and west. You know, it can be certainly argued that look at what we've achieved now. You don't need a pet passport and you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, stuff like that there. You know, so that'll make a difference.
Yeah, Damien, do you think the DUP can go in as sort of deputies to Sinn Féin? Or
they can't stomach it. That's the whole problem. They can't stomach it like that. Look, I mean, the agreements between the British government and the EU, like, so the Westminster Parliament will pass it, whether the DUP wants it or not. Like, and really, Britain has to do it because it has to be able to trade with the EU, regardless of what the DUP thinks. Really. So there was a time a couple of years ago when Theresa May was dependent on their votes, and they're not dependent on them now. And so the DUP now, their problem does seem to be is that they're being attacked from the right through the likes of Jim Allister and his traditional unionist voice. Who are, of course, playing the traditional unionist card of no, nay, never. So they're afraid. And it is probably, Thomas, probably right that they're not going to do anything until after the May election. They're in a whole huff about the idea that things might be got up and running, the storm might be got up and running ahead of the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. They keep talking about, oh, no, we don't work the anniversary, 1690 and the 12th of July. And all that. Like, what about these other points? So, they can't really, they're obviously, like, unionism is psychologically shocked by losing its majority of MLAs in a previous election and then losing the position of First Minister in the most recent election. And this is just some of the shockwaves arising from that. But ultimately, the British government will get it through because even if there is rebellion from some of their more extreme Brexiteer members, I mean, the Labour Party has already said that they're going to support the deal. So there'll be enough votes to get it through the British Parliament. And I thought that's kind of what the DUP
and I think even with
like,
the ERG, they're not going to make it a political problem for Rishi Sunak either. And that's why I sort of said at the beginning. Barbara, I was listening, watched a little bit of Newsnight last night, right? And the people of Sunderland, the people of Wales and representative from Scotland were going, hold on, this is not fair. You know, Northern Ireland are getting a competitive advantage now. They're still in the EU and we're not. Like, it's almost otherworldly, really, to be honest with you, because you have people who voted to leave the EU complaining that part of Britain and Northern Ireland is in the UK, and this is unfair, but we all should have that.
Exactly.
Which is kind of where they were at a few years ago.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at it, Northern Ireland did not vote for Brexit. Now, neither did Scotland. So Scotland can very justifiably feel hugely aggrieved at this, that Northern Ireland is getting this special status. And I think what maybe is beginning to dawn on people in England is that there's a terrible anomaly going on here. What do we do with Northern Ireland? And I think the reality is, I would very much agree with Damien, you know, the DUP are not going to play second fiddle to Sinn Féin. They just cannot conceive of that as being in any way acceptable. And so they will reject this. Now, as you say, the Westminster government will put it through anyway, but the DUP will be seen in England, Scotland and Wales as having rejected this. And people are going to go, who are these?
But what does that mean in an election, for example? Because, you know, people might not go, people who vote for the DUP might go, they go, well, this is, we're getting nowhere. I'm going to vote for someone else. But they don't necessarily go and vote for Sinn Féin or the SDLP. There's loads of other parties up there now where you can sort of move away from a party that you formerly supported, but you don't have to, you know, you don't have to cross the aisle as such. You know what I mean? Like, because there are politics at play here and people's patience, even, you know, the DUP supporters' patience might be wearing thin, so they have to see how this plays out for them as well. There's nothing guaranteed in the North anymore, I don't think.
No, there's not, and I think that's why you see Sinn Féin in the position where they will be holding the seat of First Minister, because many DUP supporters are beginning to look at them, even over the whole thing of, you know, of Brexit and of Arlene Foster arguing for Brexit and, you know, loyal unionist farmers and business people in the North going, wait a minute, Brexit doesn't work for us. We don't want that. And beginning to realise that the DUP agenda is not actually about supporting their own people or the people of Northern Ireland more widely, or the six counties or whatever way you want to name it. It's not about that. It's a much more tribal thing than that. And I think people are getting tired of that, and their votes are taking them away from the DUP, so that the position of a group like Sinn Féin becomes strengthened, not because they're coming across to vote for Sinn Féin, but because there are less voting for the DUP. Mm. And I think we may well see that replicated again in the next election, because the DUP is not changing. It's not going to somehow begin to engage with people again and leave people feeling that they do actually have their genuine best interests at heart.
And we had a reminder, of course, with the shooting in Omagh of, you know, what it used to be like in the North. I mean, we don't want to go back to that position, do we, Deputy Pringle? I mean, what's your view on that shooting? Are you in the business of condemnation in that regard?
Well, there's absolutely no way we want to go back to that. I mean, we've had 20-odd years of a reasonably peaceful peace process and getting through and changes that happen. And we're at a very important time at the minute, I think, in terms of the breakdown of the unionist majority as well in the North. So that's going to be a time that should be worked through peacefully, I think. And, you know, and ultimately, if the people in England and that there are unhappy with what the North has got and what are they going to do about it, they could actually leave and we could have a united Ireland, and then they wouldn't have to worry about it in the future. And, you know, and I think that's what we're moving towards, and I think that's something that we should be preparing for as well in the South. And maybe Brexit is going to actually speed that up and showing that it's possible and doable as well. And I think that's all part of the playing into this. And it is maybe a difficulty for the DUP now that they won't be able to go in. I don't think they'll be able to go in with a junior minister or a second minister to Sinn Féin's first minister. But I think they'll work through that as well. They might go with this idea of the opposition registering as opposition and do it that way. And that will serve a normalisation as well too, I think, in the overall process, because the fact of everybody being in government in the six counties has gone a course as well, I think, because you have to have some sort of normalisation of the political process there as well too. So that means having government and opposition too. So I think it's all flux and change at the minute, but I really don't think we'll see any real change until after the local elections, and you get the window between that and the next general election in the six counties.
Damien Dowds, editor of the Inishowen Independent newspaper. Do we need more transparency in the cost of electricity, and should government apply a windfall tax to suppliers, or even maybe just explain to us how the whole system works? Damien's gone, so I'll go straight to you, Thomas, if that's all right. You know, we don't really know how all this works, really. You know, I've said on the show a couple of times today, wholesale prices, when do they buy it? How much do they buy it? Do they exhaust those higher prices that they pay before they start buying it on the cheap? You know, maybe we're using cheap electricity, but they've got some way of, you know, we need answers to those questions, because we indemnify them. They can never lose money because we're always covering the cost. How does it all work? Like, we should know this. And as I say, it's not a criticism of the government, but I don't need Simon Harris to ask the questions that our listeners are asking. We need them to give us the answers and to drag them in front of a committee and to explain. You know, we don't need, you know, ministers for understanding the situation. We want answers.
Yeah, and there seems to be a whole system of not providing, not getting the answers, and not, and what they have to do, what they seem to be wanting to do, is to avoid asking the questions so that they don't have to listen to what the answers are. And that they're, and it's bizarre at the moment. Like, but as I understand it, like, and I suppose I'm no expert on it either, but then for the windfall tax will be a tax on the additional profit that companies have made over the increase in the cost of electricity. And that would be companies doing renewable generation and stuff like that. So the element that they would make profit on that, because renewable electricity is benefiting.
But Thomas, does that not say, right, we yous are gouging, we know you're gouging, you're not going to do anything about it, so we're actually going to just take the money off you? I mean,
the whole system is set up for gouging. I mean, that's what it's about. That's what capitalism is about, Craig. Like, it's about gouging. It's about maximising profit when you can. And, you know, and that's why the government are kicking and screaming against this windfall tax. And they've dragged their heels on it for so long because they don't want to actually... To actually do it. And I've made doubts as to whether this will happen at all, because there is a case being taken in the European Court of Justice at the moment by ExxonMobil against, I think it's Belgium or something like that there, that where they tried to impose a windfall tax, and they're taking a case in that. So if the Court of Justice rules against them and that, the government will watch their hands up and say, well, we can't do it anyway because European courts have stopped us.
Although maybe the windfall tax in this country, I believe, is actually on the retailers, not the wholesalers. So maybe...
That might have a difference in relation to it. I'm not sure, you know. And the government... It seems very reluctant to do this, and that's part of the problem. And, you know, and the householders have been left high and dry in relation to it, you know. And then we have the government introducing this €500 energy tax or energy break on your bills and that there, which is applying to every single person in the country, whether you need it or not. I mean, that's just nonsensical and something like crazy. No. You know, and if I own 10 houses and I've a holiday home dotted around the country, I'll get 10 times the energy break and where I don't need it because I own all these houses, and people who are struggling all the time will get one break. It's crazy stuff, like, you know.
As I say, Damien, we don't really know how it all works. You know what I mean? Like, we don't. We just accept it. We have, you know, senior members of government spinning ads, well, you know, prices go up quickly, but they come down slower. We know all of that, of course. Yeah, but what, rather than just punish them by taxing the profits, what can we do to have transparency? Let us understand what's going on. We are the consumer. How does this all work? You know, but I suppose, and I should note that the €200 has already arrived for some people on pay-as-you-go meters over the last couple of days, and there's a further 200 for everyone in the audience over March and April, dependent on when your bill comes out. But anyway, to the wider point, more transparency, we need answers, Damien.
I say we need more solar panels, Greg, so we can start generating some of our own power and do away with some of these points. But it's a thing that we never paid a while out of attention to. Your electricity, the bill was coming in, it was at a certain level. But I suppose over the last 8 or 12 months, we've all had to start thinking about, you know, are we using too much? Like, I was even looking at my own bill, I've been open in front of me here, just, you know, I put down my usage a fair bit, like, I'm in the house with three kids and my wife and stuff, like, so we were in a position, the lights are left on, whatever else, you know.
I just spill the beans, Damien, we don't need your life story, tell us how much the bill is.
No, but you're just, you know, tell us how much the bill is, Damien. We've got the bill was $435 for two months. Which is a lot more than it was.
It's up
so much than it was, like, it's like £180 up on the same period last year.
Sure.
You know, and that's with less usage as well. But there is a wee note on my bill as well. It says that due to wholesale energy prices, we've regrettably increased our electricity prices from the 2nd of October 2002. I thought wholesale energy prices had gone down.
Well, so they are even, a fraction of where they were.
But they're using, they're still, they've kept...
But what they should say to you is, they should say to you is, due to us hedging, and we could hedge at a higher rate for a certain amount of period of time that we don't know, but because we knew you'd pay your bill like a good little boy, the prices are going to stay high. They haven't told you for how long did they buy electricity in advance, when did they expect it to run out, are they buying lower price electricity now, can they not provide that at a medium average between the high rate they paid and what they're probably borrowing at a lower rate now? You know, but they just say to you, they feed you the whole wholesale price.
That line, that they've put in there since October last year, which isn't the current case now. Like, but look, it's a tricky one, I suppose. Like, and you know, Thomas, I heard Minister McGrath, the finance minister, now on the radio this morning, and he's saying that yes, they're preparing the legislation for the windfall tax. And you know, they're still preparing it. I guess a wee bit like, I suppose, the draft regulations that we're waiting on for the mega redress. Like, you know, I mean, it'll always be ready, but it'll be ready next week. Now, you know, it's never done at maybe the pace that we might expect it could be done. And presumably they are going to be able to apply a windfall tax, and they are probably a little bit resistant to it. They want to get their eyes...
Yeah, but we don't know if that windfall tax is going to be sold to us as a clawback from the credits we've already received, or if it's going to go against...
You see, and it's in the hundreds of millions is the figure he put on this morning. He wasn't talking... You know, he's talking about the hundreds of millions. Like,
okay.
It's been a real challenging time for people, like, during this... credit or energy crunch, like, and the bills have, as they say, shot up, and you know what the government can do to bring them down isn't all within their gift. I know Thomas is saying that's the capitalist system, like, you know, and that's how it goes, and they're afraid to interfere with it a wee bit, like, but you know, I don't know, it mightn't be the worst system either to be under.
Listen, Damien, thanks for that, Damien. Barbara, I presume your views align to some degree with all the comments so far. We've a couple of minutes left. Do you want to use that couple of minutes to talk about Seachtain na Gaeilge whilst we have you on?
That would be great.
Yeah,
that
go
would be
ahead.
Wonderful. Yeah, Seachtain na Gaeilge from now until the 17th of March. Lots of opportunities, you know, for people to get out and to speak Irish. We have our usual Circle Cora on a Tuesday morning at 10. There's a trad music session in Dillon's Hotel together with Cultus on the 14th. A pop-up Gaeltacht, lots of, you know, come along, whether you're fluent or you're a learner, whatever, come along and use your Irish. On the 15th, there's an event here in our office at from 12 until 2, just a drop-in event for businesses. Come in and find out about Forest na Gaeilge's business support scheme, about Glory na Gael's Gradam business recognition, and about the local Gradam Gaelic Lagro business award as well, you know, and just find out about the possibilities for using Irish and that buzz that's around for the companies that are. And then on the 12th of March as well, there's a walk from the head of the Glen in Glenveagh. There's a bus leaving Letterkenny. Again, the aim is to get people out speaking Irish, go for a good walk, you know, have the chat, get to know new people, but an emphasis on speaking Irish. So there's lots happening. Lots of opportunities, and we would encourage people, you know, to try the cup of focal. Everybody has a bit in them there somewhere. We have loads of people learning with us at the moment, people from all over the world learning Irish with us. And it's, you know, it's about who we are. It's about our identity. It's about our understanding of ourselves. So, you know, Tappy and Jesh and the Lin Shark and the Gaeilge and get about Gaeilge Lorch.
Yeah, and I suppose if you're big in about Ireland and the importance of Irishness and all that kind of stuff, learn a bit of Irish maybe. Would be no harm. Right, okay, Barbara, lovely to have you on the programme. Take care of yourself. We'll give that another plug early next week. Bye-bye, Barbara. Slán, that's Barbara Ní Cathal. Thomas Pringle, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much, Greg. Pleasure.
Appreciate it. Stuff we didn't get to, but we shall again. Last but certainly not least, Damien Dowds, editor of the Inishowen Independent newspaper. Damien, have a lovely weekend.
Slán go
fóill,
Greg.
Slán go fóill. Okay, thank you very much indeed. He takes instruction well there. Right, 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number if you get to get involved in the conversation. 086 60 25,000. Or give us a call on 07491 25,000. And just to let you know, we've got some interesting news coming up on the programme a little later on. There's a wee trip away to see a musical legend. We'll give you some details on that and so much more besides. So stay right where you are.